It occurred to me before the show that solipsism, or the problem with the external world, is like the perfect response to any argument you happen to disagree with. You know, if someone criticizes something you have to say, you can just say, hey, why should I listen to you? I don't even know if you're real.
There you go.
This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 10 of Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me is Zachary Frueling. In this episode, we'll be discussing the problem of the external world, which is the problem of how we can know that the world we experience is real. Now, Zachary, I know you're real. You're at least a real hologram. You're a real picture on my view screen here.
But how can you know for sure? That's the $64,000 question, isn't it?
Indeed it is.
how do any of our listeners know that either of us is real, for that matter? We're just voices in their car speakers.
I hear voices.
No, seriously, this is one of my favorite philosophical topics. It's I think this is, of all the topics we could discuss in when talking about Star Trek and philosophy, this is one that Star Trek fans should be able to latch on to pretty easily. Mainly because Star Trek plays with this idea a lot with the holodeck, and I'm thinking of examples like Moriarty in the holodeck. How do you know that the universe you experience is real and that you're not just a hologram, the world around you isn't just a hologram, or some variation thereof? So this is a fun Star Trek-y kind of topic for me.
Yeah, I agree. This is going to be a very fun topic. And we'll talk a lot about the holodecks, but there's some other corners of the Star Trek universe, I think, that approach this question. And I agree with you wholeheartedly when it comes to Star Trek and philosophy. This really is one of those great conversations, and I think we have a huge body of examples in the Star Trek universe to pull from. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Well, let's start us off by diving right into the topic. What is the problem of the external world in epistemology? Well, this is a pretty easy idea to understand. Again, it's one of these things where if you're really a hardcore Star Trek fan, you like talking about ideas, I think this is going to be a fun idea for you to latch onto. You've probably thought about this already in some way. If you don't like thinking about abstract ideas and somewhat crazy ideas, this topic is not going to speak to you much. But the basic problem is just that, how can you know that the world you experience, this external world that we seem to perceive through our senses, right? You know, the world that I see and taste and touch and smell, these are phenomena that we get through our senses, and we tend to presume that there's a real world out there, that it's not just a figment of my imagination, that I'm not just a brain in a vat, I'm not stuck in a holodeck, that world is real. But the question is, how can you know for sure, right? It's one thing to have some intuitions that the universe is real. It's one thing to say I've got some sensory inputs, but when it comes to the question of knowledge, you know, you want to have a stricter bar for knowledge. You want to answer the question of certainty. How can we be certain that this external world that we seem to perceive is real and not just one of these variations that you get in the Star Trek universe? How do you know you're not just on a holodeck? How do you know it's not just a hologram? How do you know you're not a brain in a vat? In other franchises, it would be things like, how do you know you're not in the Matrix? That's a well-known example also from the 90s. But that's the basic problem. How can you be certain that the external world is real and not merely in your mind?
This is going to be a tough episode, probably, for someone out there who thinks that the holodecks are ridiculous. It's interesting because I remember the first time I ever saw a hologram. I was a teenager. And I was in the mall in my little hometown, And it was a flower, Zachary, a hologram of a flower etched on a piece of glass, and not a hologram like we would associate with Star Trek, but nonetheless, I remember looking at that thing, and it seemed to float there in the glass. It was three dimensional. You flipped it over. It was the bag. It was fascinating to me, and I remember thinking then. Again, and I'm a teenager, and Star Trek Next Generation had just come on TV, and I remember thinking, we're almost there. So I've always enjoyed holodeck episodes, and, you know, perhaps somebody out there who feels that, the holodeck episodes are ridiculous, and Star Trek fans aren't fickle at all, are they? But someone who thinks that the holodeck is ridiculous, or if you're a niner out there, the holosuites, if you think the holosuites are ridiculous, then this episode might be a tough pill to swallow. But the philosophical debate itself is a rather fascinating one, and it's one of those debates, Zachary, that I have to be honest, I've never completely got my mind around. And anytime I humor myself to think about it, it usually ends up causing mental cramps.
Well, you know, the holodeck is one of these double-edged sword kind of plot devices, right? It opens up the field of possibilities for the writers. They can tell any kind of story they want. And on the other hand, it can be totally overused to the point where it's too easy to tell a holodeck story rather than fleshing out real drama, right? So there's this debate back and forth about the virtue of the holodeck as a plot device. But as an example of this question, the problem of the external world and skepticism of the external world, how you can know that the external world is real... The holodeck is a phenomenal example, because even some of these other examples that you get from the history of philosophy, like one of the well-known ways of telling this story is to talk about a brain in a vat. How do you know you're not just a brain sitting in a jar somewhere with a bunch of wires and electrodes and tubes plugged into your brain, feeding you all of this sensory input directly into your brain, being skeptical about the rest of your body and the external world around you. But even those kinds of examples, they rely on some sort of real world, right? There's really a brain and really a jar, really a vat, right? What's fun about the holodeck is you can really sort of push the limit in terms of how far you can push the skepticism. Like, I'm thinking of Professor Moriarty in that TNG episode, Ship in a Bottle. And from Moriarty's standpoint, even though he knows he's a hologram, unlike most holograms, he learns that he's a hologram and becomes somewhat self-aware, similar to the Doctor. By the end of that episode, Moriarty is put inside of this, small ship in a bottle, basically a miniature holodeck with no visual display, keeping his program running to the point where he's going to live the rest of his, presumably, life, sort of in irony quotes, right? He's not really alive, maybe, but in his life in irony quotes, he's going to live the rest of his life inside this computer program simulation running inside that data cube. Mm-hmm. And, that's a more radical way of telling the story, right? Because, if you take the brain in a vat version of the skepticism of the external world, you at least have to posit some sort of a world, even if it's just a brain in a vat. And, there's this kind of story with all this stuff you have to tell in order to make that story make sense. But with the hologram example, it seems like you can go, wow, how do I know that literally, I'm not just a non-physical computer program with nothing, with no world at all, no physical world at all around me. And of course, to tell that story, you almost have to invoke, you have to invoke holograms, you have to invoke holodecks and whatnot. So maybe that's not the greatest example either from a radical skeptic standpoint. I also want to spend a minute as we dive into the discussion talking about Cartesian skepticism, because I think in the history of philosophy, René Descartes takes the most radical approach to skepticism of the external world. But the holodeck example strikes me as a really rich example, because it speaks to this radical skepticism. How do you know you're not literally stuck in a holodeck where every single thing you're experiencing is just being fed to you by some computer program and isn't real, real physical world?
Yeah. Yeah. You were talking about, a brain in a vat, and, that example always kind of takes me back to the argument of solipsism. Solipsism comes from the Latin solus, meaning alone, and of course the other part of that referring to self. So the idea of being self alone. It's the idea that only one's own mind is sure to exist. The idea first came to be recorded by a Greek philosopher, a pre-Socratic philosopher, Gorgias. And he stated that, you know, first of all, nothing exists. How's that for a philosophical idea? And then he supposed that if even something exists, nothing can really be known about it. And even if something could be known about it, then knowledge about it can't be communicated to others. So that was the idea behind solipsism. So wrap your mind around that for a moment, if you can.
Well, you know, it's funny because this is one of these things where, you know, you really have to motivate people to take this idea seriously. Like, you know, you can imagine someone throwing their hands up in the air and saying, you know, why should I care about this idea, right? Yes, okay, maybe I'm in a holodeck, maybe all the memories I've had my entire life are just false memories, maybe it's all a computer program, maybe I'm a brain in a vat, whatever it is. Why should I take that idea seriously? So I think you do have this pragmatic challenge to overcome. And that's an interesting question, how you go about answering this problem, this question. If you're a pragmatist, you're just going to reject the question outright. You're going to say, you know, my pragmatic life is so wrapped up with this idea that the world is real, and I can't get outside of that enough to even take the question seriously. And so pragmatists like William James would just reject the question outright. But an epistemologist like Descartes, who really wants to push the idea of mathematical certainty, is going to take the question much more seriously. But that's a really valid question. You know, should our listeners even take this question of the external world seriously, or is it a question you can just dismiss out of hand from the very beginning?
Yeah, my instinctual inclination would be to reject this altogether. But that being said, when I do sit down and I really give it some thought, the thing that really gets me about this argument, and it may be a lack of my own philosophical chops, my lack of bandwidth, I'm not sure, but as I ponder the questions, you know, do I really exist? And if I exist, you know, if the world around me exists, what can I really know about it? And the problem here, Zachary, for me, is that I lack the ability to really prove it. And, you know, every serious philosopher that I've ever talked to about this have always come back to the idea that, no, that's what makes this such a great argument. You can't prove it.
You know, I'm trying to think of ways to look at this through the lens of Star Trek. And as you were talking, the question I'm asking myself is, does Star Trek help or hurt in motivating the question of the external world? On the one hand, we seem to have learned a lot more about the natural world. Like, I'm comparing us to, say, Descartes, right? You know, Descartes was a modern philosopher right at the cusp of the Copernican Revolution. And you know, while they were starting to learn a lot about the natural world at that time, without a doubt, you know, in the last 100 years, you know, our knowledge of the external world has increased, you know, hundredsfold, right, if not thousandsfold. So on the one hand, we seem to be learning a lot more about the natural world, but on the other hand, the types of examples you get in Star Trek, things like holograms, things like holodecks, these are really recent ideas, right? These ideas only came up in the last, 50 years, sometimes even the last 25 years or so with the holodeck on Star Trek The Next Generation. Do those ideas give more credence to the problem of the external world? These fairly recent sort of sci-fi type ways of telling the story of the skepticism of the external world? Or does the fact that we've learned so much about the natural world seem to undercut the very problem we're trying to answer? Have we learned so much that we can just take it for granted that the world exists? You know, look at all the knowledge we're getting left and mm-hmm. right. Or do these sci-fi examples, make it easier to take seriously the skepticism of the external world? What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I told you in the Turbolift coming up here that I was going to invoke the Benny factor, and our listeners are probably going to go, oh no, here he goes again, far beyond the stars, Deep Space Nine. Yes, I am. And one of the reasons why I always kind of whip this out is because I think philosophically this is a rich episode, first of all. But the end of that episode really struck me because at the end of the episode, he's talking to his father and he says to him, you know, maybe, just maybe, Benny isn't the dream we are. And so he's wrestling with the question, you know, am I the dream or the dreamer? And I think that that's really at the heart of this debate. And again, it's not an easy question to answer. And I don't think really for himself that Ben Sisko ever really answered that question.
I think what's hard about this topic is, you know, especially when you're dealing with skepticism, you can almost always, in response to whatever reason you're looking at, whatever reason for thinking that we actually know something or thinking that the external world is real, you can always ask the deeper question, well, how do you really know that, right? you can just keep asking that question again and again and again until you realize at the end of that sometimes long reasoning process, maybe we really don't have any good final justification that settles it one way or the other. So, you know, of all philosophical topics, this is one where, you know, I'm sort of forced to throw my hands up and go, you know, I just, you know, maybe we just can't prove it at the end of the day, you know, and then you can ask all the practical questions like, you know, so what, does that really affect my life? Is that a crisis in any way if I really don't know for sure that the world exists, or pragmatically, do you just move on with your life? But I think that's one of the hard questions, because you just keep coming back to this raw skepticism. You can keep pushing that skeptical line of reasoning as deep as you want to. Well, how do you know that? How do you know that? How do you know that? And it's awfully satisfying at the end of that line of reasoning to realize you got nothing.
So, yeah.
So as we dive in, let's think about some other ways of telling this story in Star Trek, right? So we've got the ship, the TNG ship in a bottle example with Professor Moriarty. What other examples can we come up with of skepticism of the external world through Star Trek before we start talking about some of the examples from the history of philosophy and maybe some responses from the Star Trek universe itself?
When you're talking about skepticism of the external world, you know, it's interesting, and I'm going to throw this out there. Our fantastic editor Dennis Costello had just popped a message up, and he said, you know, do Starfleet officers need to take a test to tell if they're still in the holodeck? I think that's a great question. I think they should have to, because if we've learned anything over the years, through the different iterations of holotechnology, going all the way back to, let's just start at Ship in a Bottle and let's work our way forward to Voyager, that I think really got into holodeck technology. Deep Space Nine, the holosuites, not as much, although we see some examples of alien beings taking over the forms of holodeck characters. In particular, If Wishes Were Horses is an episode that comes to mind where a holodeck character, Ben Bacai, he comes out of the holodeck and visits with, you know, and is he real or is he not? You know, Buck Bacai. I said Ben Buck Bacai.
So listeners at home aren't necessarily going to know this from listening to the podcast, but most of the time when we're recording Metatrex, we have our editor and producer, Dennis Costello, looking at us on the screens and commenting on what we're doing, pointing us in the right direction, viewing us certain directions. And Dennis has a fabulous question, which is that how do you, when the holodeck is on, when you enter the holodeck, how do you ever end up knowing that the holodeck is off? How do you know that you've left the holodeck? And that's the, from a Star Trek perspective, that's the great question, right? How do you know, how could you ever distinguish between being in a holodeck and not being in the holodeck? And I think in some of the examples in Star Trek, there are some answers to that question. Like, I'm thinking of the episode Future Imperfect from Star Trek: The Next Generation. That's the episode where Riker is ends up in a Romulan holodeck and is presented with the illusion that he is some years in the future, 10 or 15 years in the future, and he's captain of the Enterprise, some sort of future, mm-hmm. but slightly skewed future timeline. But it's all an illusion, right? He's in a holodeck. And how does he end up realizing that he's in the holodeck? And I think, you know, in most of these examples, there are some clues along the way, right? Things start to not add up, little imperfections in the story, little differences between the way reality ought to be and the illusion that's being presented. And that's almost, you know, from a story standpoint, you need something like that, right? You know, in order for the protagonist of the story, the character, to realize that he or she is not in that he or she is just in the holodeck still, you need some sort of clues, right? You need something that triggers like this realization, oh my God, this is just an illusion. This isn't real. But the reason I sort of think that's not a really adequate response is you can just imagine a better holodeck, right? You can imagine a better holodeck program that didn't have these imperfections, mm-hmm. That ran for a longer time. And, you know, of course, you can always say, well, what if you were just born in the holodeck, right? what if Naomi Wildman had been born on the holodeck on Voyager, mm-hmm. right? And just grew up inside a Fairhaven. Can you imagine growing up inside Fairhaven? Wouldn't that be the worst illusion to grow up in ever, by the way?
I don't know. Zachary, I just watched Fairhaven, kind of prepping for this show, literally right before we turned our mics on. And that actually is one of my favorite, holodeck episodes. And there's a very, very rich, philosophical conversation that takes place between Captain Janeway and the Doctor that we'll get into after a bit. But, I can think of worse places in the world to, be born and grow up than Fairhaven.
But I think we all sort of have this reaction, right? When the world gets a little weird, you start to go, am I dreaming? Is the world really getting so crazy that this is real? And, you know, that's a great point. I think the point is that, you know, this is one of the ways we do distinguish reality from illusions or from dreams or from being in a holodeck, right? There's a coherence and a reliability to our experience in waking land when we're not dreaming that allows us to distinguish at least between a dream and reality. I don't think I've ever seriously mistaken one of my own dreams for reality, but I've heard a lot of different people with different types of dreams in mind. Some people have more vivid waking dream kinds of dreams where they're dreaming and they know they're dreaming to the point where, mm-hmm. you know, they phenomenally can't tell the difference between, you know, experience in the real world and experience in their dream world. Dreams have never been like that for me. But, you know, that's one of the questions. Is there a way to distinguish genuine experience of genuine reality from any of these types of examples, holodecks or dreams or otherwise?
For Tuvok, I think it was his holodeck wife's his fake Ponfar partner, where it was her ears were about a centimeter off, I believe.
What? You threw me for a loop.
That's what I'm here for, everybody.
So we've got the future imperfect example, right? Where in Riker's example, or Riker's holographic experience being in a Romulan holodeck, things just start to not add up, and he clues into the fact that this isn't a real scenario. But you know, what do you think? I mean, is the idea of having such a perfect holographic program to the point where you literally can't distinguish between reality and the holographic experience? Would there always be some sort of clue that gives it away, or can you imagine a perfect program where there are literally no clues? I think it's easier if you're born in the holodeck, right? If Naomi Wildman is born inside the holodeck, then she's not going to have any clues. She's just going to think that's all that there is.
Yeah, the imperfections, you know, the occasional, you know, glitter on the wall type of thing that usually happens that set people off to know that they're in a you know, a holodeck recreation. You know, there's always that little glitch. There's always, you know, the Starfield blinks out for just a second, or, you know, there's that little shot of the gold and black grid on the wall, just out the corner of your eye. There's always something there that lets you know that this isn't quite real. For Riker, you know, and interestingly enough, Riker has an experience where, I think I can say this, he genuinely falls for a holodeck recreation in the episode, and I'm going to botch this, you know, 11000110.
Yeah, that one.
101. He falls for a holodeck character that was created to you know, divert his attention, and she did it quite well. I think there's something to be said there that, you know, because she looked so much like Janeway, I think there's maybe an Easter egg in that episode about Riker being attracted to Janeway, but that's a conversation for another show. But interestingly enough, his key-in was, at least in Future Imperfect, was that she was a holodeck recreation. Aha. They tapped into real feelings that he had, but he was able to correlate that with his experience, knowing that that was a holodeck mm-hmm. recreation, and he figures it out. Aha. He had his aha moment. But that's the way it always happens. Anytime they try to, in the Star Trek universe, and for that matter, I can think of other franchises where they try to have this scenario where somebody's going to get lost in, you know, in a hologram, in a holocreation, and something isn't quite perfect about it. I go back to, the very first episode of Star Trek, The Cage, the original pilot. It was that same thing for him. It was too perfect. It wasn't the way he wanted to live his life. He recognized that, you know, all of it was an illusion and he wanted no part of it.
I think what's interesting about the different ways that Star Trek has told this story over time, like you mentioned The Cage, that's sort of a psychological, telepathic way of telling this story, right? You're being manipulated mm-hmm. telepathically. Now we sort of have this technological way of telling this story. You might be in a holodeck or you might be a brain in a vat.
Sure.
And, you know, it's just interesting how the story has evolved over time. Like when Descartes was thinking about his own skepticism of the external world and whether you can know that it's real, and asking this really fundamental question about what you can know for certain, you know, what if anything can escape this radical skepticism? Can we be left with any knowledge whatsoever? You know, for him, it was things like dreaming or being possibly deceived by a divine being that's not omnibenevolent, but more like an evil genius or an evil deceiver. That was Descartes' way of telling the story. That's the universe that he knew. And then, in the early 20th century, you get this very psychological thread, you know, with the development of modern psychology. So at the beginning of Star Trek, even despite the technological aspect of Star Trek, you get this more psychological way of telling the story in The Cage, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in the 90s, you get this technological way of telling the story. But it all boils down to the same thing. How can you know that the experience that you're receiving is real? So it's fun to see the evolution of the story, but I'm not sure that the evolution of the story makes it any easier to find the answer, right? And if anything, maybe some of the technological way of telling the story is a distraction from the fundamental problem, right? If there's always a tell inside the holodeck, if there's always that glimmer on the wall that gives it away, then there's a reason for knowing that you're in a holodeck, right? But if you take something like René Descartes' skepticism, how do you know this isn't a dream? Or how do you know you're not, that every time your mind reaches some sort of a conclusion that you're being deceived into thinking that is a genuine perception? That strikes me as a bit more fundamental than these technological ways of telling the story.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking about all the different ways Voyager handles this question, and they really do a lot of holodeck episodes. I think the situation...
Yeah, this would go in the category of, I'm trying to think, who put it this way? Brannon Braga's weird shit? Right? and you know, and it's funny because a lot of people criticize those kinds of stories. Oh yeah, that's Brannon Braga's weird shit. That those kinds of stories, right? They're not political stories, they're not character stories, they're weird shit stories. You know, as a philosopher, those are the ones that really force these really abstract philosophical and metaphysical and epistemological questions for me. So yeah, bring on Brannon Braga's weird shit in Voyager.
Yeah.
Now, I think we fleshed out the different ways of telling the story. There's only so many. They're all variations on a theme, right? How do I know that my experience is real? Am I a holodeck character? Am I stuck in a holodeck? Am I brain in a vat? Those are all basically the same story. So let's dive into some possible answers to that question from the history of philosophy. And when I think of skepticism of the external world, an even more radical skeptic than the well-known Scottish skeptic David Hume, I think in this regard, is René Descartes. And René Descartes, he's a mathematician. In fact, you've probably heard of the term Cartesian coordinates, right? When you were mm-hmm. doing algebra back in the day, right? Descartes was the mathematician who came up with Cartesian coordinates. But as a philosopher, given his role as a mathematician, he was asking this really fundamental question: is there anything I can know for certain that has the degree of certainty that you get in mathematics, this mathematical precision certainty that escapes any of these skeptical worries? And so for Descartes, in the course of his well-known work, Meditations, in fact, he literally was meditating by candlelight over a series of nights. When you read Descartes' Meditations, it's fun to like turn the lights down mm-hmm. and, you know, pretend you're reading along with him and doing the meditations along with him. And that's part of the journey. This is Descartes, you know, sitting there in a dark room, a dimly lit room with a candle, asking, what can I know for certain, given that I'm, you know, just me sitting in this room, getting all this phenomena, the candlelight flickering and whatnot, you know, all of his past experiences, and then these skeptical concerns. How do I know that any of this is real? And asking these really fundamental questions. And as a mathematician, he starts to analyze this systematically. He starts by doubting everything he can possibly doubt. That, and as you dive into Descartes' meditations, that's how you start the journey with Descartes. Descartes starts asking, what kinds of things can I doubt? And how can I push that doubt to the highest possible degree, with the goal of trying to decide, is there anything left over that's not subject to those kinds of doubts, and then use that as a foundation to build up a new system of knowledge. And of course, you know, he's doing it in real time as you read the meditation. So, you know, Descartes, he starts by asking things like, well, how do I know I'm not dreaming? And he considers a lot of the kinds of things we've already talked about. Well, you know, I know I'm not dreaming because when I'm waking, things are really vivid. And when I'm dreaming, things seem to be a bit dimmer. So there's this kind of phenomenal difference between waking life and dreaming life. Just like in the holodeck, right? Things don't seem to add up all the time in the holodeck. So mm-hmm. Yeah, we can kind of dismiss that. There's a coherence to our ordinary experience. But in the holodeck, there's always a glitch in the system, right? You always see that glimmer in the wall.
There's always a glitch.
There's always a glitch. Exactly. Sometimes there's glitches in real life too, speaking from experience.
Darn those glitches.
So he says, okay, well, I can be reasonably assured that I'm not dreaming, but how else can we push this radical doubt? So he starts thinking like a mathematician. What about simple things like 2 + 2 = 4, these mathematical principles? Surely those kinds of things are still true, regardless of whether or not the physical world exists or not. And Descartes pushes this doubt really, really radically. He says, well, you know, maybe my mind was set up in such a way that every time I come up with a mathematical conclusion, I'm just designed to get it wrong. Maybe, you know, God, the creator, you know, designed me in such a way that every time I do a math operation, I just get it wrong. And God is, you know, this evil deceiver, this evil genius. Yeah, what if God is more like Q, right? Divine trickster who set him up in such a way that he's always going to get it wrong no matter what. He says, well, God, I can't even rely on mathematics then, right? Something as simple as 2 + 2 = 4, I can even be skeptical of that. If Q, you know, is playing with my mind in real time, maybe I can't even rely on this simple mathematical reasoning. So what's left over? Is there anything at all that you can be certain about given that. And for Descartes, you know, his, because everyone knows the phrase from Descartes, I think, therefore I am, cogito ergo sum. Exactly. In fact, even Moriarty in Ship in a Bottle quotes that, although he does it totally out of context, right? For Descartes, I think, therefore I am is his answer to the skeptical problem. Basically, no matter how radical the skepticism you have, you know, if you say, maybe I'm dreaming, maybe Q is playing with my mind such that I can even doubt mathematics. Well, in order to be sitting here having these meditations, to be doubting in this sort of radical way, Descartes has this realization, well, I have to exist in order to be deceived, right? In order to, if for any of those things to be true, I as a being have to exist. And that's the I think, therefore I am. That's his new foundation he thinks he's found for knowledge, is this certainty he thinks he can have in his own existence. And of course, what's interesting for Descartes is he separates knowledge of his own existence from knowledge of the external world. Just from the fact that he exists, it doesn't necessarily follow that his body exists or that he's not dreaming, right? So he makes a division in his mind between knowledge of himself as what he calls a res cogitans, a thinking thing, and he defines that as our essential characteristics. So for Descartes, he very quickly shifts to this radical dualism, you know, this idea that he's a non-physical thinking thing that can still be skeptical of the physical world, including his own body, and then he has to try to overcome that skepticism in some way. But that's the foundation that Descartes thinks he's come up with, that, you know, and to tell this in terms of Star Trek terms, you know, even if you're in a holodeck, right, you still exist in order to be perceiving whatever's in the holodeck. So Descartes thinks that you can be certain of your own existence as a starting point. And that's the one thing he latches onto that he thinks he can overcome the skepticism of the external world.
The thing about the holodeck in the Star Trek universe, though, Zachary, is that by design, I think, it brings into question everything. And I do literally mean everything. You're talking about, you know, Descartes and, you know, trying to answer the question for Janeway and the Doctor. kind of looking at this question from the other side. And I mentioned earlier Fairhaven, and I'm going to go back to that episode. Literally, I just watched it before we recorded. And the thing I love about this episode is that Janeway finds herself in a romantic relationship with a hologram, and you know, so she is even literally rolling her eyes at the ridiculousness of it. She says, you know, well, you know the story. Girl meets boy, girl modifies boy's subroutines. But there's a really great philosophical conversation that takes place between Janeway and the doctor. And the doctor, you know, she says, basically, and I'm paraphrasing, she said, listen, this is ridiculous. He's not real. And the doctor says something very profound. He said, he's as real as I am. Photons and force fields, flesh and blood, it's all the same as long as your feelings are real. He makes a joke. You laugh. Is that an illusion? He says something that makes you think. Does it matter how his molecules are aligned? Did it ever occur to you that it's not just a question of whether or not he's real? She said, what do you mean? He says, I think you should stop trying to control every aspect of the relationship. Romance is born out of differences as well as similarities. And he goes on, but think about that for a moment. You know, for the doctor, the answer to the question, is this real, really goes back to Janeway being a thinking thing and experiencing her emotions. And those emotions are real. And he tells a joke, she laughs. That's real. He says something that makes her think. That's real. And so we're back to the question of, you know, the holodeck, these holodeck characters. You know, is it real? Well, according to the doctor, no. Photons and force field, flesh and blood, what difference does it make?
Well, there's a lot going on here because, you know, that response is very similar to Descartes' response, right?
On, mm-hmm. on the one That's hand, exactly why I thought
about
it.
How can I be sure
it?
That I exist? Well, I'm self-aware, right? Even in doubting my own existence, you know, sure, I can doubt the external world. Sure, I can doubt my body. But can I doubt myself, right? In order to even ask the question, you have to acknowledge your own existence even to answer the question. So there's this problem of other minds, right? The solipsistic problem. How do I know that other people are real? Or how do I know that the doctor is a real person? Or how do I know that Data is a real person? It's tied up with the issue of personal identity that we talked about a few weeks ago. Because, you know, if that holds for me, then surely the same thing holds for them, right? If those people are self-aware, if the doctor is self-aware, and the characters in the holodeck become self-aware, whether it's the bartender inside that episode of Fairhaven, whatever his name is, Michael Sullivan, right?
Michael Sullivan.
Yeah, I couldn't remember the name.
Katie O'Claire.
Or you know, whether it's Data as an android, right? What matters is their sentience, their self-awareness. And I can doubt whether other people are self-aware, right? You know, I that could be part of my skepticism of the external world. But from their first-person standpoint, those beings can be sure of their own self-awareness and their own existence. And I think that's Descartes' point. So it's fun to kind of tell this holodeck story from Descartes' point of view. So I'm sort of envisioning Descartes sitting in the corner of the holodeck. Maybe, you know, he's smack in the middle of the holodeck, and rather than candlelight, he has the soft yellow glow of the holodeck grid around him, and he asks this question: okay, how can I know that I'm not in a holodeck? Right, this is Descartes, you know, the 24th version of Descartes telling the story. How can I know that I'm not in a holodeck? You know, I've got this dimly lit flickering of the holodeck grid, you know, playing off my hair. Right,
you got to make the staticky sound.
Exactly. How can I know? He would say, "Well, okay, sure. I'm self-aware, so I know my own existence. But is that helpful for overcoming skepticism of the external world? For can you ever reach the conclusion that you're not just in a holodeck? Can you ever reassure yourself that other people and other minds really exist just from the realization of your own existence?" And for Descartes, the answer is obviously no, right? You know, there's a whole lot more he wants to recover, right? He's trying to doubt everything possible. He doesn't just want to leave it at knowledge of his own existence. He wants to build a whole system of knowledge. He wants to know what he can rely on. And this, you got to remember, this is at a time when knowledge of the scientific knowledge of the natural world is increasing at a rapid rate, right? And so Descartes finds himself in an interesting situation where, you know, he has all these skeptical doubts, and yet knowledge of the external world seems to be growing at an exponential rate. And these two things aren't matching up in his mind. So, mm-hmm. so he's trying to overcome all of these skeptical concerns so he can be reasonably assured that the things that science is revealing about the natural world are accurate, that it's actual knowledge and not just some sort of phantasm or not some sort of an illusion. And so he needs to say, okay, well, now that I know why I exist, what else can I know? What follows from that, right? And that's where he really starts to spiral into some trouble, I think. You know, Descartes, one of the most radical forms of doubt he considers is this idea that God might be an evil deceiver, something more like Q, right? So let's just use Q as the example. How do you know God isn't like Q, just manipulating you into thinking all that, that this world you seem to experience is real? How can you know that? And for Descartes, you know, he, of course, he was a Christian theologian too at the same time. So mm-hmm. his answer is, well, if you appeal to some of the definitions of God, these things don't follow. You know, God by definition is the highest degree of all of these qualities like omnipotence and omnibenevolence. Mm-hmm. So an omnibenevolent God just by definition wouldn't be a deceiver. And that's correct. Essentially his answer to the problem. Right. You know, he basically says, you know, if you posit that God is the supreme degree of all of these concepts, then God by definition just can't be a deceiver. So mm-hmm. that's how he dismisses that form of radical doubt. But I think, you know, if you tell that example in Star Trek terms, why couldn't Q just be a radical deceiver, right? Why can't I sit here living in this fantasy, essentially, you know, ditch the holodeck example. Why can't an omnipotent being like Q have created this radical illusion that I'm sitting in? Would I have any way at all of overcoming that, that degree of radical skepticism, the Q version of Descartes' skepticism versus the God version of Descartes' skepticism? Can you come up with anything there? Because I think this is the part of the problem you run into when you have this philosophical problem of the external world. You can always just ask the skeptical question, well, how do you really know? In an example like Q, you can't even rely on his omnibenevolence, right? Q is a divine prankster.
He is.
And you know, in universe,
that's why we love him.
Yeah, and so in universe, if that's part of the Star Trek reality, if a divine omnipotent, you know, divine kind of in irony quotes, right? I think Picard wouldn't want to call Q divine. but an omnipotent being like Q that's outside space and time, that's all powerful, couldn't all of this just be an illusion from Q? And you couldn't even fall back on these theological concepts like Descartes falls back on. Would there be any way of overcoming that skepticism? Or are we just left at the end of the day with radical skepticism and maybe solipsism?
It's funny because in the Star Trek universe, it always caught me that anytime something fell beyond their ability to reason or to explain, you know, Picard would kind of look around the bridge and go,
could this be Q?
All right, this is Q. Yeah.
So, you know, so for Descartes, you know, it's interesting because he, you know, he basically overcomes all of his, you know, all these doubts that he starts with, he ends up overcoming. And I think, you know, again, you know, we talked about science and religion a couple weeks ago. If you have a theistic worldview, you might go, okay, maybe you think Descartes' arguments are great, right? Maybe God wouldn't be an evil deceiver by definition if that's your view of God. But in universe now, if you talk about Q as a divine prankster, I'm not sure you have any conceptual way of overcoming that degree of skepticism. You know, the holodeck aside, you know, there's always a glitch in the system, but, you know, Q is an omnipotent being. You know, if he's literally all powerful, couldn't this just be a Q illusion? I'm not sure what Star Trek gives us to work with to overcome that skepticism that Descartes is trying to overcome.
Yeah, they really don't. Matter of fact, I watched Deja Q the other day, and again, an example where, you know, they found themselves in a situation, and, you know, their solution to the situation was, well, this must be Q. Q shows up, you know. I love that scene where he just materializes on the bridge. He's not wearing a, you know, one thread of clothing. He falls on the floor and he looks up at Picard. It's like, red alert. that's great. But I mean, almost the first thing Picard says to him is, Q, you know, this is all your fault, fix it. And
well, it seems like the characters in Star Trek especially in the Next Generation and by extension Voyager and Deep Space Nine, are in this a similar kind of situation that Descartes is in, right? On the one hand, they seem to be learning a lot of things. They're, you know, gallivanting around the galaxy, doing their science experiments, mm-hmm. learning whatever they're supposed to be learning, right? They've got their sensors on, they're learning all kinds of stuff, right? And then you can always go, well, how do I really know, right? Couldn't Q have just, you know, facsimiled all of that, right? Couldn't this just be one gigantic Q illusion rather than knowledge of the actual universe? So you can ask this question, are they really learning anything inside the Star Trek universe at the degree of certainty, right? Can they be reliably certain about anything that they've learned, given that Q is always looming in the background?
Zachary, it just occurred to me that the final episode of Star Trek The Next Generation should not have been a time travel episode, but rather it should have been an episode in which they all discovered that they never actually left Far Point to begin with.
Well, you know, that's the magic reset button. It was all a dream, right? I mean, some shows have ended that way. Like the one that comes to mind is Roseanne, right? You know, they basically reset, mm-hmm. not the entire show, but they reset a lot of it, I think, at the end of Roseanne. You can always do that as a plot device, right? It always strikes me as kind of a lazy storytelling kind of solution to whatever you've written yourself into. But but that's the problem, right? Couldn't it all have just been a dream? Couldn't it all have been an illusion? Couldn't it have been whatever? And again, so, you know, we're sort of skirting around the problem, and I feel like no matter what we do, that's all we're going to do tonight, right? We're not really going to answer this problem, but I guess it's dissatisfying because you know if you're one of the characters on the Enterprise and you've signed up for Starfleet to go explore the galaxy, you want to be really reasonably certain that you're being productive, right? You actually want to learn something. You don't just want to constantly have the skeptical worry in the back of your mind, maybe I haven't learned anything today because of Q, right? That's a more dissatisfying approach to knowledge. And it just strikes me so wildly implausible that they're not learning anything because of the possibility of Q in the background. So mm-hmm. I think of the characters in Star Trek as in a similar position to Descartes. You know, they seem to be learning a lot of things, but there are all these skeptical worries, personified in the character of Q. How do you resolve that? How can you be, reasonably certain that the things that they seem to be learning in universe are, count as genuine knowledge?
Yeah. One of the things I think that, we in some, at least to some degree, use to define our senses is our ability to learn, to grow, as thinking things. And so it occurs to me that, a small part of this question, I think, needs to come around to holograms that are self-aware, that have the ability to learn and to grow. How do we apply the idea, at least how do we apply this problem of the physical world to, say, the Doctor, or the swingin'est hologram this side of the wormhole, Vic Fontaine?
Well, I love that you mentioned Vic Fontaine because, you know, he's one of my favorite holographic characters, of course. He is swinging on top of everything, but he, he knows he's a hologram, right? Unlike most holograms, the Doctor knows the Doctor's mm-hmm. a hologram, but Michael Sullivan inside that program in Voyager doesn't know that he's a hologram. So a self-aware hologram is interesting, but is that any more helpful for solving the problem of the external world? Can a hologram be any more? Does the knowledge that you're a hologram make it any easier to be assured that the things that you're experiencing, in the holodeck, of course, you know, if you know you're a hologram and you know you're in the holodeck, then there's no question, right? The things you're experiencing aren't real. They're just holograms. But does that make it any easier to solve the problem of the external world for the rest of us?
Yes.
I think you're on to something, right? I mean, I think the hologram that knows he's a hologram can be assured that what he knows what he's perceiving, right? He knows that it's not real. At least that's some sort of knowledge, right? It's more than Descartes seems to have when Descartes doing his skeptical worries.
I'm not your average light bulb.
Knowing for sure that something's not real seems better than not knowing whether it's real or not. So that seems like a little bit of progress, but mm-hmm. it doesn't seem to address this more radical question. How about the world at large? Is that just a hologram or not? So I think we've kind of exhausted the Descartes line of reasoning. I sort of feel like the characters in Star Trek aren't any better off than Descartes was at really being able to address that fundamental level of skepticism. So let's talk about a couple of other possible answers to the problem of the external world from the history of philosophy. One that comes to mind, it's an interesting one. We mentioned the brain in a vat example, and the philosopher Hilary Putnam had a really interesting critique of the brain in a vat argument. And the idea is just this, that it strikes me as a little bit of linguistic wordplay. Basically, he said that not everything that looks like it refers really genuinely refers to something. You know, suppose for an example that an ant happened to draw out a picture of Winston Churchill, you know, in Walking Around the Sand. You wouldn't say that that picture genuinely referred to Winston Churchill, right? It just happens to resemble a Winston Churchill. So, you know, if you really take this brain in a vat reasoning and run with it, you can ask the question, what about the proposition, I'm just a brain in a vat, that linguistic proposition that's either true or false? He would say, well, if you're just a brain in a vat, the term brain probably doesn't refer to a real brain. At least, you know, all of our reasoning for thinking that a brain exists is tied up with this sense of being part of a physical world. Same thing with our notion of a vat, right? So these terms, even though they sound like real linguistic terms, just wouldn't refer to anything in that situation. So the proposition "I'm just a brain in a vat" would be false because the terms would fail to refer in that case. The reason we think about reference is because of the sense of an external world that we have. And if you are questioning this sense of an external world, then the key terms involved in this case, brain and vat, just wouldn't refer to anything. So it's a false proposition, the idea that you're brain in a vat. And he basically rejects the brain in a vat example because of this linguistic reference problem. And it just strikes me as linguistic wordplay left and right. It just strikes me as not really recognizing the seriousness of the problem, especially in this technological age when we can talk about holodecks and we can talk about holograms. You know, we can talk about virtual reality, right? In the real world here, we can talk about, you know, putting your 3D glasses on, sure, and maybe everything you're seeing is just some, you know, enormous 3D virtual reality program. You know, those are you know, relatively recent concepts that I think make it easier to take seriously the skepticism of the external world. So I'm not convinced that the linguistic answer is much of an answer. But the other possible solution I wanted to talk about tonight was from the philosopher Bishop George Berkeley, who is an idealist. He basically agreed with the skepticism of the external world, that the external world in some sort of physical independently existing thing didn't really exist. Are you familiar with George Berkeley, Mike? Do you want to take this one? Or do you want me to dive in?
No, go ahead. I have vague understanding.
So Berkeley's interesting. You know, he's also wrestling with this problem of the external world. And so he's asking this question, why do I think that the external world is real in the first place? What features of my experience give me reason for thinking that the external world exists? And of course, he comes to the somewhat obvious conclusion that it's all tied up with perception, that, you know, he perceives the external world, and that perception is a mental activity, right? I get ideas and impressions of what seems to be an external world in my mind. And so he realizes that he can't think of a way of understanding the external world that isn't wrapped up with perception in some way, or isn't wrapped up with ideas in his own mind. Mm-hmm. That's his entire reason for thinking an external world is real, is because it's all wrapped up with these mental perceptions that he has of the external world. And that seems right? If you're in the holodeck, right, you're perceiving the holodeck, you are conscious of the things you seem to be perceiving. It's a very similar point to Descartes in that the experience is fundamentally a mental experience, but he's not satisfied with the outright skepticism of those things. Berkeley then says, well, you know, that insofar as I have this idea of the external world, and insofar as it's wrapped up with the idea of perception, that must be the thing that grounds reality. You know, and the typical sort of philosopher story, you know, the thing that gives philosophers a bad rap is asking questions like, well, if a tree falls in a forest and, and, you know, you weren't around to hear it, how do you know that the tree really had, right? These kinds of stories, right? These gives philosophers kind of a bad rap. But this comes from Berkeley, you know. The question is, well, okay, if reality is fundamentally a mental thing, What reason do I have for thinking that it persists when I'm not conscious, when I'm asleep, or when I'm daydreaming or whatever. I don't think the world just blinks out of existence. What is the reason for taking into account the permanence of the external world if it's fundamentally a mental thing? And of course, you know, Berkeley gives, like Descartes, he gives a theological answer to that question as well. Berkeley basically says, well, God is not just omnipotent and omnibenevolent. God is all perceiving, right? God perceives all of reality as a total, being outside of space and time. And it's fun because you can kind of tell this story using Star Trek examples. You know, well, okay, if it's not God that's doing the perceiving, Q, being outside space and time, is able mm-hmm. to perceive all of reality as a whole all the time, and that omniperceptiveness of a divine being, you know, God for Berkeley, but you know, in Star Trek, you can say, you know, Q is an all-perceiving, omnipotent being. You know, he's able to perceive all of reality, whether or not I'm perceiving any particular thing, right? So if a tree falls in a forest, I may not be able to perceive it, but someone who's able to perceive everything as a whole, a being like Q, is able to perceive all of reality. So that's what grounds the permanence of the external world, is that it's always being perceived by something all the time, namely these beings that are outside space and time. It'd be God for Berkeley. But, you know, in universe, you can say, you know, a being from the Q continuum would be able to perceive all of reality as a whole. And so you know, Berkeley, he has this interesting solution to the problem of the external world. Basically, he wants to say that the skepticism of the external world is correct insofar as the external world is not made up of physical, material things that exist independently of the mind. And so in that sense, you know, he's totally okay with saying, yeah, okay, skepticism of the external world, the external world doesn't exist in that sense, because he can't think of a sense of the external world that doesn't immediately rely on his own perception or this mental perception of, mm-hmm. of the external world. And so for him, the external world is not really external. It's a mental world, you know, in the mind of God, or in universe, it's in the mind of Q. You know, this is just a perception of the Q continuum. And the reason it's a solution to the problem of the external world is that he's not saying it's not real. And I think this is what's fascinating about Berkeley. He simultaneously says, yeah, as a physical thing that's independent from the mind, the physical world does not exist. So he's a skeptic in that regard. But that's not to say it's not real. It's just ideas. It's just perceptions. Not some physical materialistic thing. So he's really kind of a middle ground between radical skepticism and full-blown knowledge of the external world. And, you know, is it a very satisfying answer? I think, you know, are all the things I perceive in the external world, the things that science seems to teach us about the external world, the things they seem to be learning about the universe while they're gallivanting around the universe on the Enterprise, are all of those merely ideas and perceptions? There's something a little dissatisfying about that, and I worry a bit that maybe it's redefining the nature of reality and just dismissing the problem by redefining the terms a bit. But that's his answer. Mm-hmm. His answer is that, yeah, the external world doesn't exist as a physical thing, but that's not to say it's not real. It's just ideas and just perceptions. And there's this well-known phrase that is used to capture Berkeley's meaning. It's the phrase, to be is to be perceived. In Latin, it was esse est percipi. To be is to be perceived. And that's what it is. You know, what does it mean for the external world to exist? Well, it's to be perceived, if not by mm-hmm. me as a finite individual being with limited perception, then by an omnipotent divine being with that's all perceiving, or in universe, you know, an omnipotent, you know, maybe a trickster like Q, but a being that's able to perceive all of reality at once. That is what it means for something to exist in some sort of static, permanent way for Berkeley.
Yeah, that's interesting. The idea of perception, that's kind of counter to the idea that a watched pot never boils.
Data would say, right, you know, what about my internal chronometer? But for Berkeley, right, what is the reason for thinking that pot exists, that there's really water boiling, that it's going to boil eventually? Well, it's because it's being perceived. And what's the reason for thinking it continues to exist when I, you know, leave the room? It's, well, for Berkeley, it's because it's still being perceived by something. It's being perceived by a divine being, or, you know, by Q in universe. You know, Q is perceiving everything all the time. So the pot continues to exist, you know, when it's not being watched by a human. That's because it's always being perceived by something. It's a fascinating answer. And the worry there, of course, is, you know, has they just redefined reality away? Is that really what we want out of the external world, or is that a satisfying answer?
Yeah. And, you know, Zachary, I think one of the reasons why this is such an important conversation, and I'm, you know, I like to goof around and schlep with the rest of them. But I think one of the reasons why this is such an important question and why it's so important that even for our listeners who perhaps maybe aren't as versed in the philosophical arguments, this is still an important question because we live in a world of changing and advancing technologies. And so I'm thinking about, you know, first-person video games. I'm thinking about we're really on the cusp of emerging AI, artificial intelligence. I think that these are questions that we are going to find ourselves asking more and more.
Well, hell, Mike, we even fight virtual wars, right? I mean, you don't even need to go
yes,
to war
exactly.
anymore, right? You can just put your virtual reality, goggles on and you know fly the war machines around, you know, while sitting in a chair. So the line between what's virtual and what's real has already been blurred, maybe more so than you realize in day-to-day experience. And the stakes in those kinds of examples are really high.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm not sure what conclusion you can draw from that for the purpose of this discussion, but I think you make an excellent point that it's not a purely abstract discussion with
it's
no
not.
Real import, right?
Yeah, it's I mean, not.
These are literally questions of life and death, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, I think I go back to the original series, you know, there's a virtual war going on and, you know, it's all mathematical calculations. And then they march people off to death chambers based on these mathematical calculations. You're talking about, we fight wars, with video games. Frankly, Zachary, we train our military troops out there with these video games. This is how we condition them to act and react in real situations on the battlefields. So I think for us to just, and I don't say us, you and I, because you and I think we both take this, you know, these questions seriously, but why this is probably a much more serious question than I think most people probably allow it to be, is that we're living in a world where we are literally, as we speak, redefining what is real and what isn't. And, you know, we really need to put some energy and some thought into answering these questions for ourselves.
You know, it's a little bit of a red herring from the original topic, which was just how can I be sure that the external world is real? But you make a really interesting point. You know, if it's possible to fight a virtual war with some real practical implications, you do want some way of distinguishing between what's real and what's not. You don't want to get so caught up in the
yes.
virtual video game that you lose your regard for what's real and, you know, real lives out there in the real world, right? So you want some way of distinguishing between what's real and what's not and what has genuine value because it's real, and what things are merely virtual, maybe without the significance or the meaning that we attach to things that are real or real people in the world. And, you know, it certainly follows from this question of whether the external world is real. And like I said, in this day and age, the lines have been blurred. You don't even need to, no matter what you're studying, you can study it virtually, right? You can study art history virtually. You can learn everything you want about the Mona Lisa from purely some sort of online virtual simulated kind of experience, right? You don't need to go see the real Mona Lisa. In what sense do we even need to learn about the external world, given this, that almost anything you want can be simulated
yes.
in this day and age? You know, it's like, I'm trying to remember which Star Trek episode this discussion comes up in. Maybe you can help me remember. It's the episode... Oh yeah, it's the episode where Picard goes back to Starfleet Academy and he encounters Boothby, and Picard tells Boothby, you know, why are you pulling the weeds by hand? You should just use a good herbicide, right? And he says, and you could explore space on a holodeck, right? That's
yes.
that's not real.
That's
you know,
great.
It's not real gardening to do that, and it's not real space exploration to explore space on a holodeck. But the point is, you could do that, right? You could simulate an awful lot of reality in the especially in Star Trek when they have the holodeck at their disposal and they seem to be able to simulate whatever they want. What value is attached to reality? In other words, is if anything you want can be simulated, you know, what value does reality have? Does it lose its significance in some way?
Yeah, I agree completely. I was watching a program the other day on television, and it was, interestingly enough, a space exploration program. And in the program, they took real science, in which they had discovered a planet in the sweet spot, if you will. It was an Earth-like planet, about three times the size of Earth. And, you know, a real discovery, something that they had real hard data on. But interestingly enough here, Zachary, they took virtual reality type technology and extrapolated. And so they're presenting this in this television program. But it was difficult to tell, you know, what was based on somebody's extrapolation sitting in an editing booth, or, you know, what was actually real. I mean, it was presented kind of that way. And we've all seen these types of programs where you're watching it and you don't know what is real and what isn't. So again, you know, these are important questions for us to ask.
And I think, you know, at the end of the day, you can always just ask this pragmatic question: so what? Right? You know, if you can't be certain that you're not, you know, part of some non-physical perception of the Q continuum, right, in universe, you know, if every day you wake up, you know, and put on your Starfleet uniform and you go, oh my God, what's the point today? Because this all might be part of the Q continuum. That's just not a realistic situation, right? Those characters are going to get up and do their jobs and find the meaning that they find in things. And, you know, I think there's this worry that this question of the external world just doesn't have the practical import that some other questions in philosophy, like questions of politics or questions of sociology, seem to have. Mm-hmm. Right. But you make a really interesting point that if the lines between what's virtual and what's real have been blurred, then there's a lot more practical import, right? We seem to be able to learn a lot more through simulation. So that wasn't true at all in Descartes' time, right?
No, absolutely.
He couldn't learn about reality through simulation in the way that you can learn about reality now, right? And that is that a way of overcoming these skeptical concerns? I mean, part of the worry about the external world was the fact that you can't distinguish it between that and a simulation, right? That was the original problem we started out with tonight. How can I tell that, you know, I'm not just in a holodeck and not just in some sort of simulation? But if the ability to simulate itself seems to be revealing new knowledge about the world, if you can learn something through the simulations, that's a really interesting solution to Descartes' problem that he finds himself in, you know, 400 years ago.
Indeed. Well, Zachary, we've been talking for a little bit over an hour. Do you want to share any final thoughts?
Yeah, I'm not sure what I have in the way of final thoughts. I think that this is a fun topic from a Star Trek perspective because you get obvious examples like the holodeck, right? We love talking about these kinds of examples. I'm not sure that any of those examples are really necessary to talk about skepticism of the external world. I think that some of the radical skepticism that Descartes talks about seems to be even more fundamental than this technological way of describing skepticism of the external world. Although we did seem to reveal some really interesting ways of telling the story, right? You know, we talked about Descartes' concept of God as an evil deceiver, which generates some of the skepticism about things like mathematics. You can tell that in universe through the character of Q, right? Q serves that divine trickster sort of role in this discussion if we want to talk about skepticism through the lens of Star Trek. And same thing with Barclay, right? We can talk about Q as a omnipotent, all-perceiving being, and not have to tell it in terms of Judeo-Christian theology. We can talk about it in universe through the characters in the Q continuum that seem to have some of these attributes that these key arguments in the history of philosophy relied on. So I think we did learn a bit tonight about how you can use Star Trek to talk about this problem of the external world. At the end of the day, I sort of think, you know, maybe it's not a really practical problem. I'm still going to wake up and have breakfast and go to work tomorrow, right? So in that sense,
where are you?
It's not a fundamental problem, but you know, when I am sitting there staring at my two eggs, and you know, my smiley face eggs are staring back at me, and you know, I'm going to wonder, are these eggs real? You know, there you can always push the skeptical reasoning. And if you take knowledge seriously, you know, I think all of us are, one of the things that we like about Star Trek is this sort of humanistic technological vision of the future. The characters in Star Trek learn something, and that's part of the reason for going out of the universe in the first place. Part of the reason for walking out my front door in the morning is because I might encounter something new, right? Why not just stay at home and watch Star Trek otherwise? but if that's the case, if part of what it means to go out your front door, part of what it means to get in a starship and go cruising around the universe is to learn something, you want to ask the question, well, how can I know for sure that the things that I'm learning are real knowledge and not merely an illusion, not merely a perception of the Q continuum, right? So I wouldn't mind revisiting this in terms of this discussion and focusing purely on scientific knowledge and see if we can give an account of scientific knowledge that itself overcomes these skeptical concerns. Because one of the things that one of the sleight of hand tricks that maybe Descartes employs that generates this discussion that makes it seem really impractical from a practical standpoint is Descartes has this really rigid view of knowledge, right? It has to pass the rigor of mathematical certainty. And if mm-hmm. knowledge doesn't have that degree of rigor, it just doesn't count as knowledge. And he's a radical skeptic. So we've really kind of framed the skepticism of the external world in Descartes' terms. How can I know for sure with mathematical certainty that the external world is real? And if the bar is lower than that, Descartes would say it just doesn't count as knowledge. But there are other theories of knowledge besides that mathematical certainty type of knowledge that we can talk about in future episodes. So I sort of feel like maybe we stack the deck a bit using Descartes' terms to talk about the problem of the external world. But, you know, I think it's not unreasonable to do that. I think if you can't be certain of something, you know, intuitively and instinctively, our gut reaction is, well, if I'm not certain, I don't really know it. You know, if you don't know that you know it, in other words, we hesitate to call something knowledge. You know, an intuition doesn't count as knowledge. A gut feeling doesn't count as knowledge, right? You know, this idea of certainty, being able to say, I know that I know something, is where we intuitively place our sense of knowledge. And if it's less than that, it's reasonable to say, well, maybe it's not knowledge. You might have good reasons mm-hmm. for thinking something, but is it knowledge, right? Does it meet the bar of certainty? And so I think the next discussion to have when we pick up this thread again is to talk about knowledge itself. Are there other ways of talking about knowledge that don't invoke this rigid degree of mathematical certainty that Descartes seems to be invoking? But, you know, all of those other ways of thinking about knowledge seem to not meet the bar of knowledge, right? They seem to be closer to gut feelings or closer to having a little bit of empirical evidence. You know, I think there's an intuition about certainty that we want to not just know something. We don't just want to have some good reasons for thinking the conclusions that we draw. We want to be certain of something. We want to know that we know the conclusions that we draw. And if something doesn't live up to those standards, then it's reasonable, I think, to say, well, maybe it doesn't really count as knowledge. So I guess for my final thoughts, this is just part one of the discussion. We need to move into a discussion of knowledge itself and see if there's other ways of conceiving of knowledge in general that gets us outside this paradox of the or problem or skepticism of the external world. So at the end of the day, I'm still going to get up and go to work tomorrow is the long and the short of it. I'm still going to put that Starfleet uniform on if I'm a character in the in universe.
I talked about Gorgias and solipsism. You know, is the world around me real? And that's what we've been talking about, the problem of the external world and trying to answer the question, how can I know that the world we experience is real? I'll say this again, and again, I don't want to repeat myself, but I think it's a much more serious question, I think, than most people will take it, because I think we all reason, at least on our own level and in our own way, that the world around us is real. You're going to wake up in the morning and you're going to eat your eggs. I'm going to get up in the morning and grab my oatmeal bar, and I'm going to get in my car, and I'm going to drive down, you know, the North Dallas Tollway. And
yeah, I want to believe that the other podcasts that I listen to on Trek FM are real.
They're
in the car tomorrow morning.
I hope they're real. I hope you're real, or else. You know, I spend time talking to my phone and to my computer screen. I hope Dennis is real, or else, you know, I'm...
Yeah, we're going to have to edit this podcast
I'm hallucinating
ourselves,
notes here on the screen that he's sending us. But in actuality, I mean, we could have talked about not Reginald Barclay, not to be confused with Bishop Barclay. Reginald Barclay and how... the make-believe world, if you will, of the holodeck shaped him as a person, how he was different as a result of his interactions with Hollow characters and Hollow worlds. I think about It's Only a Paper Moon, which is one of my favorite Star Trek episodes of all time, as Nog wrestles with his own post-traumatic stress disorder and escapes to the world of Vic Fontaine, and that becomes very real for him. Mm-hmm. And so much to the point that he completely escapes, you know, to that world, and all efforts to draw him back out into the external world fail. They tried to give him doses of reality and, you know, show him that he was missing out on important things in the lives of people sure. that he cared about. But it didn't work. He was so steeped in Vic's world. And Vic says something to him very profound. You know, if you spend too much time in here, you'll become as hollow as I am. And so at the end of the day, I think, again, the importance of this question and answering these questions, I think, is becoming more and more urgent for us because of the world that we live in, because, you know, we have AI, and because we have, you know, virtual reality. We need to define terms of what's real. Do we define those terms in ways that explore emotion and experience? You know, if you hit a pool ball and it hits another pool ball, can we come to the conclusion that the two pool balls are real because they struck one another? I think these are far more important questions, and it's fun to look at them in the Star Trek universe, but it's really easy to kind of dismiss the whole thing as, you know, ridiculous fantasy, science fiction, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, these are serious questions. And you know, again, it's fun in the Star Trek universe, and I hope our listeners enjoyed the conversation today. But at the end of the day, these I think are important questions for us to grapple with in you know, a world that is becoming less and less real.
Well, I love that you mentioned, you know, Barclay, Lieutenant Barclay, Bishop Barclay, but Lieutenant Barclay, because it's no accident Reg. That he's named Barclay, right? I don't buy for a minute that's an accident.
No, I think that was on purpose.
But Barclay, you know, we didn't talk about this much, but Barclay is the character that's in danger of losing himself in Voyager, right? And Barclay is the character that at the end of that episode in TNG, when the characters didn't realize they were still on the holodeck, Barclay's the one who looks up into the air and goes, "Computer in program." really skeptical. He's not quite convinced that he's not still in the holodeck, and maybe he shouldn't be. Maybe he can never really know. So Barclay is a great example of what it might mean to get lost in some sort of virtual world. Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about the problem of the external world tonight, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Usually Mike and I are like,
what's going on? Our heads are just spinning like, what? I don't understand what's going on, you know? And like, you know, when I listen to that, I'm like, are we like, you know, bad?
The orb.
He requested, you know, a Bajoran officer to serve with him on purpose. You know, he understands. You make this their own.
I'm glad he did it on purpose. I could see him like accidentally requesting a Bajoran officer. Oh man, I checked the wrong box on the form. Damn.
The ready room.
Actually, I think at this point, Vulcan Love Slave was probably just a short story, right? It hadn't been turned into a full-blown
That's right. It's not a full-blown novel at that point. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
just fanfic. It's just fanfic.
Yeah, just fanfic.
Just on the internet. People started writing after First Contact there in Montana.
To the journey! It's a very much the genesis of Seven of Nine.
Genesis alone is not. Sorry.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
So we're closing in on the World Series is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, the Sox were able to win the World Series in, you know, 12 games. So we're no White Sox, but we're like the Cubs or something. Oh, no, wait. They didn't win the World Series. Never mind.
The 602 Club.
To speak back to the lightsaber overall, I mean, it was practical reasons that they switched it to green. But I've always loved the fact that Luke had that green saber, even when I was a kid. Like, it's really cool. It's an immediate visual signal, you know, even outside of the outfit that he's wearing, that he's a different kind of person than even we saw in the previous film. And I really like that.
Literary Treks.
The pinnacle of episode that we've ever done on that was probably when we had Tristan from To the Journey on to talk about some Voyager comics. And we ended up, that show was named Tuvok's Remedial School for Badasses or something of that nature. So, I mean, yeah, these old comics can just be very, very fun.
Meta Treks.
I looked it up, and ornare is the Latin word for to adorn.
That's fascinating.
So I looked up breca, and it turns out the same spelling, B-R-E-K-K-A, is Old Norse for slope or hillside.
And that, listeners, is something you will only get right here on MetaTreks.
Better living through etymology.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. And be sure to get in on our MetaTreks iTunes review contest running between now and January 15th. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all of the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways.
You can contact us via a handy form on our website. Go to trek.fm/contact.
To leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page. There's a link there, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
You can find us via Twitter. Our Twitter username is @trekfm.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm. And be sure to find us in the Babel Conference. That's Trek FM's listener group. Just go to the Facebook search bar and type in Babel. That's B-A-B-E-L. And the Babel Conference will come right up. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. We also invite you to leave a rating and review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. And this is just a final reminder about our MetaTreks iTunes Reviewed contest running between now and January 15th. Well, Mike, when you're not stuck in your own holographic universe, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs these days?
Well, you can always find me on Facebook via the Babel Conference. Also Twitter. My username is @cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not matching wits with Moriarty on the holodeck, where can our listeners find you?
Well, you can find me as a guest on several recent episodes of Trek FM's flagship show, The Ready Room. You can also find me in the Babel Conference if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me anytime. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name. That's Zachary Fruhling, ZacharyFruhling. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network, specifically C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Dennis Costello, our editor and producer. Thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast, everyone. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.
Well, I got news for you, Vreenak. We're all fakes. That's what Sisko should have done. He should have had a very philosophical conversation. Well, stick this in your cap, Vreenak. We're all fakes. None of us are real. We don't know. Am I the dreamer or the dream? I don't know. Do you?